Good morning. You are now tuned to the Figure of the Age Civil Rights Talk Show and Hour of Power. Now, here's your host, the incomparable Errol Miner.
Good morning, human rights activists all over the world. Welcome back to Communication Workers of America, CWA Human Rights Hour Power, a justice-filled hour of talk, solidarity, and worker power right here on KYOK 1140 AM and the all-new 106.5 FM. And if you are visiting the beautiful city of Houston, you can take us home with you on kyokradio.org. And listen live every Thursday morning at 10 a.m. Central, 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Also, you may listen to us on our CWA app, CWA Strong, and you can also download to your favorite podcast player, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube Music, iHeartRadio, and Podchaser. Thank you for joining us on the CWA Human Rights Hour Power Radio Show this morning. It's about us. That's right. It's about us. Working agreements, solidarity, living wages, worker power, and simply human rights. Honk your horns, everybody, if you support workers. We have a phenomenal show lineup with you this morning with Sir Reginald Small, Maikia Jones, Timia Wiley. So don't you dare change that dial. Tune in this morning. We will be talking about Voter Buster of the Week, redlining, and the Hour Power Trivia. Wake up, everybody. No more sleeping in bed. Our union voices are ringing in every district from Alaska to Maine, Texas to Minnesota, Canada to Puerto Rico, because we don't play at CWA. Our union brothers, sisters, and siblings at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette have been outside for 24 months striking on the picket lines. And yet, while they're out striking, they're still churning out the news with facts for you and me. Let's show our support to them by making sure we subscribe to unionprogress.com. And once you have subscribed to this free publication, how about going over and donating to their strike fund at cwa.org/PPG-donate. And I just heard someone shout in the background, when we fight, we win. Our brothers, sisters, and siblings at Maximus are still fighting for a contract. And we ask that you continue to support the workers of Maximus and their families by going over to cwa.org/CCW Solidarity Fund. You are tuned into into KYOK 1140 AM and the all new 106.5 FM. And you can always take us with you on your favorite podcast. Lilly Ledbetter, an iconic figure in the fight for pay equity, has made significant contributions to human rights, women's rights, labor rights, and civil rights through her activism and advocacy. Human rights encompasses the basic freedoms and rights that every individual is entitled to, regardless of gender, race, or nationality. Lilly Ledbetter's advocacy for fair treatment and equality reflects her contribution to human rights, particularly in the workplace. Her fight for equal pay highlights the right of all individuals to receive fair compensation, regardless of gender. By pursuing her legal battle against Goodyear, Ledbetter underscored the importance of economic equality as a fundamental human right. She emphasized how fair wages and working conditions are intrinsic to human dignity and how income inequality perpetuates broader social inequalities. Lilly Ledbetter is most famous for her role in advocating for women's rights, particularly in relation to equal pay. The Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act of 2009, named after her, was a milestone for women's rights. After discovering that she was paid less than her male counterparts for the same job at Goodyear Tire, Ledbetter fought all the way to the Supreme Court, losing the case, but igniting public awareness about pay inequality. The law changed the statute of limitations for filing pay discrimination claims, enabling women to challenge unfair pay more easily. Ledbetter could reflect on How pay inequity limits women's opportunities for financial independence and professional growth, which are central to women's rights. Let Better Struggle for Fair Compensation also ties into broader labor rights issues, such as the right to equal treatment, collective bargaining, and economic justice in the workplace. By challenging Goodyear, she stood up for the rights of all workers to receive equal pay for equal work, a core principle of labor rights. Her advocacy didn't just impact women, it benefited all workers by highlighting systemic wage discrimination. She would even discuss the importance of labor unions, collective action, and advocating for labor rights to ensure that workers are treated with dignity and fairness, stressing that no one should work for less simply due to gender. Although her case was primarily about pay inequality, Ledbetter's work also intersects with civil rights, as the wage gap often disproportionately affects women of color and other marginalized groups. While her fight began as a personal battle for fair pay, it expanded into a broader civil rights issue. Her story sparked a national movement to rectify the systemic inequalities faced by women and people of color in the workplace. Ledbetter highlighted the intersectionality of gender, race, and economic justice, emphasizing how civil rights and labor rights are intertwined. Ensuring fair wages for all women also helps address the racial pay gap, which is an ongoing civil rights issue. When it comes to human rights, we can discuss the universal right to fair pay and how it is a fundamental part of human dignity. The universal right to fair pay is essential to upholding human dignity, as it ensures that all individuals are compensated justly for their labor, regardless of gender, race, ethnicity, or other identity factors. Fair pay reflects the value of a person's work, contributions, and time, and it plays a critical role in fostering equality, economic justice, and individual self-worth. So why fair pay? Why is it a universal right? At its core, fair pay is tied to the right to work and earn a livelihood, which is enshrined in numerous human rights documents, including the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Article 23 of the UDHR states that everyone, without any discrimination, has the right to equal pay for equal work. This means that all individuals should receive compensation that reflects the value of their work, regardless of their gender, race, or other personal characteristics. And it's just simply linked to human dignity. Human dignity is the inherent worth of each person, as it requires that all people are treated with respect and fairness. Compensation is a direct reflection of how society values an individual's contributions. When people are underpaid or subject to pay discrimination, it sends a message that their work, and by extensions, they themselves, are worthless. This undermines a person's sense of self-worth and dignity. Fair pay enables individuals to support themselves and their families, providing basic necessities such as food, housing, and health care. This self-sufficiency is fundamental to living a dignified life. Fair compensation acknowledges the value of a person's labor and contributions when pay is inequitable. Workers feel respected and valued, reinforcing their dignity and sense of belonging within society. Without fair pay, Economic inequality grows, perpetuating cycles of poverty and limiting social mobility. Fair pay is essential for reducing inequality and creating a just and equitable society where everyone can thrive. Pay discrimination, whether based on gender, race, or other factors, is a violation of the right to fair compensation and a direct assault on human dignity. It denies individuals the opportunity to reach their full potential and reinforces harmful societal hierarchies. Women, particularly women of color, often face wage discrimination. This not only leads to financial insecurity, but also signals their labor is less valued than that of men. Lilly Ledbetter's own case is a clear example of how pay discrimination can erode dignity. People of color, especially Black and Latino workers, also face significant wage gaps compared to their white counterparts. This discrimination devalues their work, contributing to long-term economic disparities and reinforcing social inequities. Fair pay is not just about wages. It supports broader human rights by providing individuals with the financial means to participate fully in society. When people are fairly compensated, they have access to education, healthcare, and housing. They can also engage in civic and political life, furthering the exercise of their civil and political rights. In this way, fair pay is interconnected with human rights, including the right to an adequate standard of living and the right to social protection. At this time, now we welcome Timya Wale onto the show to begin talking about women's rights and highlighting their own battles for equal pay when it comes to Lilly Ledbetter. Good morning, Timya.
Good morning, Errol. How are you this morning?
I'm wonderful. And yourself?
I'm doing all right. I can't complain. I will say that, well, you know what? I am going to complain. We have a long ways to go as a society when it comes to leveling out the pay field for women, and especially as people of color. Just a little background information on Lilly Ledbetter. In 1979, and this is for people who don't know who she is. In 1979, Lilly Ledbetter began a career with Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company in Gaston, Alabama. She held various managerial positions and received regular raises, what she thought was regular raises. At the beginning of her career as a supervisor, she was earning the same pay as her male colleagues. But in the late 1990s, she failed to receive a raise for 3 years in a row. After almost two decades of working there, she learned through an anonymous letter that she was being paid significantly less than her male counterparts. Ledbetter was paid $3,727 per month. I'll say that again. Ledbetter was paid $3,727 per month, while the lowest paid, and I'm going to say that again with a little emphasis, the lowest paid male area manager was paid $4,286 per month. This led her to file a lawsuit against Goodyear for being paid less than her male counterparts. Lilly went on to win her first case against Goodyear, but the 11th Circuit overturned the judgment. Lilly didn't stop there, though. She pressed until the Supreme Court heard her case. The Supreme Court ruled against her because she did not file her claim within 180 days of the discriminatory policy that led to her reduced paycheck. Okay, so just to run that back, as the young kids say, I'm gonna run it back. She filed a claim, she won her claim, but the 11th Circuit Court dismissed her claim because she did not file within 180 days of the discriminatory practice being paid less. Now, how in the world, if you've been getting paid less for years, and you only find out through an anonymous tip, can you notify someone? It doesn't work that way because this has been going on for years. It happened way before 180 days. But even though, with all of that said, Lilly kept pressing, and in response, Congress later passed legislation called the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. It was actually one of the first bills signed by President Obama when he came into office. So even though she did not receive any payment for it, she kept on pressing, took it to the Supreme Court, and we now have the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act of 2009. The Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act sought to restart the $180 clock every time a discriminating paycheck was received. This act was implemented to reverse the Supreme Court ruling in Ledbetter versus Goodyear. Congress pushed it one step further and removed the statute of limitations. Under the legislation, every discriminatory paycheck or other compensation can be filed unrestricted from a period of filing a pay discrepancy claim. Passing the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act still did not result in her receiving a settlement or any restitution from Goodyear, but Ledbetter finds joy and peace in passing the Lilly Ledbetter Pay Act 3 years after its signing in 2011. Over 350 cases were heard because of her legislation. In her own words, "I told my pastor when I die, I want him to be able to say at my funeral, I made a difference." And she made a difference in the lives of all who are being paid unjustly and unfairly because of the color of their skin or their gender or any other anything they can be discriminated against. Back to you, Errol.
And Tibia, what else I found out in discovering or doing or looking at Lilly Ledbetter, she emphasized the importance of labor laws and collective action to ensure that all workers were compensated fairly, regardless of gender or race. The labor laws and collective actions are essential tools in ensuring that all workers are compensated fairly, regardless of gender, race, or other identity factors. And I know this is something that we've said several times, just talking about this human rights activist, Miss Lilly Ledbetter. The labor laws provide the legal foundation that ensures fair treatment in the workplace. These laws are set standards for minimum wages, working hours, workplace safety, and protections against discrimination. And without labor laws, workers would be left vulnerable to the arbitrary decisions of employers who may prioritize profit over fairness and equality. And if it were not for the labor laws, and I know we're seeing a lot of this from companies today, but if it were not for fairness and equality and the labor laws, we would still be seeing even more. Laws like the Equal Pay Act of 1963 and Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 prohibit wage discrimination based on gender, race, or ethnicity. And these laws serve as critical mechanisms for holding employers accountable and ensuring that workers receive equal pay for equal work. Lilly Ledbetter's Fair Pay Act, the legislation corrected a gap in labor laws that allowed wage discrimination to go unchallenged. It ensures the workers can take legal action when they discover pay discrimination, regardless of how long the disparity has been in place. Laws that set minimum wages ensure that workers are compensated at a level that allows them to maintain a basic standard of living. And these laws are crucial for preventing the exploitation of low-wage and marginalized workers who are often at a greater risk of being underpaid. While labor laws provide important protections, they often need to be enforced and expanded through collective actions. Workers organizing together, often through unions, have historically been the driving force behind many of the labor rights we now take for granted. Unions and collective bargaining enable workers to negotiate for better wages, benefits, and working conditions, giving them a voice in shaping the terms of their employment. Collective bargaining allows workers to push for higher wages and more equitable pay, ensuring that all workers, especially women and people of color, are compensated fairly. Unions have been at the forefront of campaigns for fair pay, better health care, and retirement benefits, all of which directly impact workers' quality of life. Women and people of color who often face systemic barriers to fair compensation benefiting significantly from union representation. Studies show that unionized women earn higher wages and have smaller gender pay gaps compared to non-unionized workers. Unions help enforce existing labor laws and fight for stronger protections against discrimination. Even with labor laws in place, wage inequality persists, particularly for women and racial minorities. This is why labor laws need to be constantly strengthened and adapted to new challenges, and why collective action is crucial to ensure ongoing progress. Women, especially women of color, continue to earn less than men for the same work. Stronger labor laws combined with collective bargaining are needed to close these gaps, and the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act is a prime example of how legislative action driven by public advocacy can address long-standing inequalities. Black and Latino workers, particularly women, face significant wage disparities compared to white workers. Labor laws must address systemic racism in pay structures. While unions can push for more inclusive hiring and promotion, practices that ensure people of color are treated fairly in the workplaces. Collective action doesn't just benefit individual workers. It shapes broader labor policies that protect all workers. Social movement for fair wages, such as the Fight for 15, have relied on collective action to push lawmakers to raise minimum wages and improve labor protections. Through organized protests, strikes, and advocacy, workers have forced the public and government to confront the realities of wage inequality and labor exploitation. Strikes are one of the most powerful tools workers have to demand better wages and conditions. Historically, strikes have led to significant labor reforms, including the 40-hour work week and minimum wage. Collective action can influence government policy, as seen in the campaign that led to the passage of the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. Workers' rights movements create the political pressure needed for lawmakers to address pay inequality and strengthen the labor laws. Labor laws and collective action are especially crucial for protecting marginalized workers, women, people of color, immigrants, and low-wage workers who are more vulnerable to wage exploitation and discrimination. Immigrants, particularly undocumented workers, are often underpaid and face hazardous working conditions. Labor laws that protect all workers, regardless of immigration status, and unions that represent these workers are critical in ensuring fair compensation and workplace safety. Minimum wage laws and collective bargaining help raise wages for low-wage workers, many of whom are women and people of color. Without these protections, they would remain trapped in cycles of poverty and inequality. Well, let's even talk about civil rights. Let's just reflect just a little while on the intersections of gender, race, and economic justice, and how Lilly Ledbetter's fight for equal pay ties into broader civil rights movements and for marginalized groups. The intersections of gender, race, and economic justice are critical to understand the broader landscape of civil rights movements. Lilly Ledbetter's fight for equal pay exemplifies how these issues are intertwined, highlighting the systemic inequalities that marginalized groups face and emphasizing the importance of economic justice as a fundamental component of civil rights. Lilly Ledbetter's case highlights the gender pay gap, but it is crucial to recognize that women of color experience even greater wage disparities. The wage gap is not just a gender issue, it is compounded by race, ethnicity, and other identity factors. Women of color, particularly Black and Latina women, earn significantly less than white men and even less than white women. For instance, Black women earn approximately 63 cents and Latina women around 55 cents for every dollar earned by white non-Hispanic men. This systemic inequality underscores the necessity of addressing both gender and racial discrimination simultaneously. The economic injustices faced by women of color affect their ability to achieve financial stability, access to quality health care, and invest in education. As a result, these disparities perpetuate cycles of poverty and limit opportunities for upward mobility. Economic justice is a critical component of civil rights, as the ability to earn a fair wage is fundamental to an individual's dignity and self-sufficiency. Lilly Ledbetter's fight for equal pay serves as a reminder that civil rights movements must address economic disparities to achieve true equality. Civil rights movements, particularly those in the 1960s, focused on dismantling segregation and ensuring equal access to education, housing, and voting. However, economic justice was often sidelined. The fight for equal pay and fair labor practices is a continuation of these civil rights struggles, demanding that economic equity be recognized as an essential right. Organizations like NOW and the NAACP have long advocated for economic justice as part of their missions. They recognize the fight for equitable wages and working conditions is crucial for achieving broader social and economic equality. Lilly Ledbetter's advocacy illustrates the power of collective action in addressing intersectional inequalities. Her case galvanized support from various groups, highlighting the need for solidarity among women, racial minorities, and labor activities. Movements advocating for fair pay have drawn connections between gender, race, economic justice. For example, campaigns for raising the minimum wage often emphasize that low-wage workers are disproportionately women and people of color, requiring a collective approach to combat wage disparities. Organizations that focus on intersectionality advocate for policies that consider the overlapping identities of individuals. This means recognizing how gender, race, and socioeconomic status interact to create unique challenges for marginalized groups. Such advocacy is essential in pushing for comprehensive solutions that address multiple forms of discrimination. Lilly Ledbetter's battle culminated in the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Act of 2009, a pivotal moment in the fight for economic justice. This legislation not only addressed gender pay disparities, but also served as a broader statement about the need for systemic change. The act highlighted the importance of the laws that protect all workers from discrimination and set a precedent for future legislation aimed at reducing wage gaps. It emphasized that economic justice is essential for creating a more equitable society, directly linking back to the principles of civil rights. Despite legislative progress, many challenges remain in achieving economic justice. Continuous advocacy is necessary to strengthen protection and address the systemic factors contributing to wage inequality. Raising awareness about the intersections of gender, race, and economic justice is crucial in mobilizing support for equitable policies. Education on these issues fosters understanding and encourages collective action among diverse groups. Amplifying the voices of women of color and low-wage workers is essential for highlighting their unique experiences and challenges. This empowers marginalized communities to advocate for themselves and seek justice. Creating coalitions among different advocacy groups can enhance the effectiveness of movements for economic justice. By recognizing shared goals and mutual support, these coalitions can work towards comprehensive solutions that address the needs of all marginalized groups. In conclusion, Lilly Ledbetter's fight for equal pay is a powerful example of how gender, race, and economic justice intersects in the broader struggle for civil rights. By addressing these interconnected issues, we can work towards a society that recognizes and values the contributions of all workers, ensuring that everyone is compensated fairly and treated with dignity. Economic justice is not merely an addendum to civil rights. It is foundational to achieving true equality and social justice for all marginalized groups. Through collective action, advocacy, and policy change, we can continue to push for a more equitable future that honors the principles of justice and equality for everyone. Lilly Ledbetter's story serves as an inspiration to many and reflects the ongoing struggle for equality and justice in multiple areas of life. Lilly Ledbetter passed away on October 13, 2024, at the age of 86. Her death was reported shortly after the premiere of a film about her life, which took place just days before she died. She was able to view the movie, and the movie is entitled Lily. And it is a dramatic feature film based on her life as a fair pay activist. It is directed by Rachel Filmon, and it stars Patricia Clarkson in the lead role, portraying Lilly Ledbetter's battle against wage discrimination that culminated in a significant Supreme Court case. Thank you, Lilly Ledbetter, for making a difference, something that you said you wanted to do. We honor you this day. Wake up, everybody. No more sleeping in bed. You are listening to CWA Hour Power Hour on KYOK 1140 AM and the all-new 106.5 FM. If you're on the go, you can take us with you on kyokradio.org. Turn the volume up just a little bit louder to hear the voting buster of the week with Timia Wiley.
Good morning, Errol. Good morning, KYOK listeners. Good morning, Saints and Aints. I'm back again with another Union Buster of the Week. Today, we're going to talk about redlining. We're going to highlight a crucial development in the fight against lending discrimination. The Justice Department and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or CFPB, have reached a settlement with Fairway Independent Mortgage Corporation. They allege that Fairway engaged in illegal redlining practices against Black neighborhoods in Birmingham, Alabama. Yes, this is 2024, and we're still talking about redlining. This settlement requires Fairway to contribute $7 million to a loan subsidy program aimed at providing affordable home loans in majority Black neighborhoods, alongside a $1 million investment to support the program and a civil penalty of $1.9 million to the CFPB's Victim Relief Fund. Attorney General Merrick B. Garland emphasized that this action is part of a broader initiative to ensure future generations inherit a legacy of home ownership, a legacy many have historically been denied. He stressed that redlining is still a pressing issue today not just a relic of the past. This is the third enforcement effort against redlining under the Combating Redlining Initiative, highlighting the commitment to addressing lending discrimination. Assistant Attorney General Kirsten Clark pointed out Birmingham's historical significance in the civil rights movement and its ongoing challenges with discriminatory practices. Fairway, headquartered in Madison, Wisconsin, primarily operated in majority white areas, directing less than 3% of its marketing to majority Black neighborhoods. That's less than 3% of Black people that they were approving for loans. This led to significantly lower and fewer loan applications from these communities compared to Fairway's peers. The proposed consent order, pending court approval, will enforce several measures, including establishing a loan subsidy program and opening new offices in majority Black neighborhoods. This sends a strong message that discriminatory practices will not be tolerated. But here's the key takeaway. Voting is essential to preventing such discrimination from happening in the first place. Engaging in the electoral process allows us to support leaders and policies that prioritize equality and fair lending practices. Your vote is your voice. We need to use it to create a just society. So, with all that being said, if you do not vote, if you don't participate in voting as a grown adult who is eligible to vote, you are our union bus. Errol, I just cannot stress how important voting is. And I don't know why so many people take it so lightly. Voting has been a struggle for people of color, for women, for so long in our country, and people just take it for advantage. This is how we level the playing field with a lot of this stuff. If you vote somebody in who's like-minded with you, then they will pass legislation that's like-minded with the needs that you have. I'm gonna get on my soapbox though.
Now stay on your soapbox, because we do need to talk about how we actually should vote. And you kind of touched on it just a little bit in your closing. But again, as we have been saying over the past few weeks, we need to make sure that we research our candidates and the issues.
Absolutely. You have to research your candidates, because we've all gotten to the polls, and you've got a list of people and you don't know who they are. You know, like the president who's running for president, you know, the vice president, you'll know the governor, like the bigger offices, but we don't know the judges. You find that you don't know the county commissioner who's running. And that's where a lot of the decision-making that affects you comes into play. I mean, like your judges, you have to know who your judges are that are running. Those are the ones that are sentencing people. Those are the ones that are sitting on the bench, giving out these hefty sentences, or sentencing people they're sentencing people and the crime doesn't fit the punishment. And we just let them slide by because we don't know. I'm guilty. I'm just telling you, I'm preaching to the choir. Before I became aware, what they say, when you know better, you do better. I would get in the poll box and they'd say, that sounds like a nice name. I'll vote for this person. Or I would just leave it blank. And we have to stop doing that, because there's so much going on, and it's going on underneath our noses. And when it's time for the politicians to stand on the picket line with us or to vote in a certain way, they're not necessarily doing that because we didn't vet people before we let them in the office.
Correct. And one of the things that I really listened to you about when it's coming to the voter buster of the week is understanding our local and state races. I know a lot of times people want to jump all the way up to the national, but as you said previously, local elections have a bigger impact on your community than federal ones. So you have to research those local candidates to make sure they are, well, you have identified your priorities and those individuals that we are electing are taking our priorities with them to make these laws and in the seats.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And another thing we have to do is we have to check in. Once we get them voted in, we still have to check in with them. I can't speak for any of the other states, but I know in North Carolina, the state legislators, they make $14,000 a year. That's not a whole lot of money. So you either have to be independently wealthy, or you've got to have somebody backing your campaign and helping you take sustain yourself. With that happening, sometimes you'll see people start to flip-flop, because depending on who's helping them stay afloat, they may be voting in favor of things that they that I say they'll be voting in favor of the money. And that's something you really have to, you got to stay on top of your elected officials. Just because they get in, you like what they said in the beginning, doesn't mean they're going to hold true or stand true to what they did, unless you follow up with them and make sure that they are voting in the best interest of the people in your community.
Correct. And when you identify your priorities, and it can be something as major to you or simple to you, but one of the things that are some of the things in my mind that I think about that are my priorities are healthcare, education, climate change. These individuals that we send to these various offices, these are the things that I want to make sure that whomever I vote for are carrying to the offices and making the legislative laws that have me in mind. And you are right. We do have to follow up on what the elected officials are doing once they get into office.
We absolutely do. And also, we're not the Gestapo. You know, we can always check up on them, but instead of just checking in on them, also check in to see how you can help them succeed, because there are initiatives within the community. They might need some help. They might need some resources. Because it takes a village. It takes a village to turn things around. One legislator can't do it all, but there may be some areas that he or she has identified in your community where they just need some hands on deck.
Correct. And one of the things that we can do is reach out to them and ask them, what are their needs? What are their wants? In order to assist them to obtain the office in which they are running for. And we as citizens, we must make sure that we have our voting methods in place. We've got to make sure that we have to make that determination whether we're going to vote in person, we're going to vote by mail, or we're going to do early voting. And we have to make a plan that fits our schedule. We just can't wait. Some of us just can't wait until the day of to run and vote. And we don't know what we're voting for. We don't know who we're voting for. Might not even know where to go to vote. So we must be proactive instead of reactive.
We have to be. There's nowhere. There's complacency. That time is over. That time of showing up at the polls and just checking boxes and, oh, this sounds like a good name, or I'm not voting because I don't know who this person is. That time is gone. We don't have time for that anymore. You have to have a voting plan. You have to do your research. And if I had one more ask, my ask would be to bring somebody along with you. Check your people in your circle. Make sure that everybody is registered to vote. You know, offer to say, if I'm going to the polls, hey, sis, you want to ride with me? We can go to the polls together. It's just that serious. I know y'all probably thinking, oh, this chick is crazy. She is just a madhouse for voting. I am. I am, because it's so important. It affects everything from our child care to education, how our kids are taught in the school, the kind of resources they have in school, how teachers are paid. I know as a former educator, the school system is like a revolving door. Your best teachers are your tenured teachers. Not saying anything about you could be a first year teacher, because I was an awesome first year teacher. Just saying. But I learned so much from the older teachers. And we want to keep those older teachers around so that they can teach the new ones coming in, the newbies in coming in, and impart some of that wisdom on them. And that is crucial to a society and to a school system to have the elders there to be able to teach the youngers and raise up these children in the school system.
And I just wanted to chime in really quick. Hi, guys. Good morning. It's Mykia. How is everyone doing?
Good morning.
And I just wanted to touch on something that Timia said. I just couldn't hold back. And when she said, do your research. And I feel like that is one of the most important things. We live in a time where we have all of this information that we do not ask for at our fingertips at all times. Like, you go on social media and you're just getting inundated with information, and you turn on the news and there's just people telling you stuff, and you're receiving all this information. And you go to the mailbox and there's postcards and letters and all types of mail and pieces of paper that's bad for the trees, that's giving you all this information. And we're not doing any of our research ourselves. We are being influenced and coerced into things that we don't even recognize that we're being influenced into. And it's super important to research your candidates and learn about them so that you can really make the choices and vote for people that are in alignment with what you're in alignment with. So I just think that that's something that's super important, is to really do your own research, use reputable sources for your research, and align yourself with a candidate that has the same goals and values and morals and wants the same things in this world and in this country that you do. Because like Timia said, it affects everything. It affects your childcare. It affects even down to the food that your kid eats in school. So there's so, like, you know, there, it affects, you know, what kind of insurance your elderly parents are going to have. It affects, you know, are the potholes going to get fixed in your streets or not? And then even with that, people don't even recognize, like Errol said earlier, that the federal elections don't even have as much merit over your day-to-day life, not as quickly as your local elections. So you need to research that too. Find out when your local elections are. Find out who these people are that are running for city council and in your county and for the school district. Like, those are the people that have a direct impact and a direct influence on your day-to-day life. So you really have to do your due diligence and educate yourself on what's going on around you and who these people are that are going to influence everything that you have to live with.
Correct. And when you do your research, hopefully you will not vote against your best interest.
Hopefully.
Right. So we were out. Yeah, hopefully you won't vote against your best interest. And what I've discovered, Timia and Mykia, while you have to be ready at all times to assist someone in getting signed up to vote. When we were out on strike, we had young people that were in our community or where, at the post where we were on strike. And two of them came by and they asked, what were we doing out here? So we had to take the time to explain why we were on strike and then turn around. And my question to them was, are you a registered voter? And guess what? They were not registered voters. And we asked the question. I asked the question, why aren't you a registered voter? And some of them, one of them said that because they're going to do what they want to do. And my reply to him was, you can make the change. Your vote does count. One raindrop can make a difference. One voter vote can make a difference. And I wished I had time to talk. Go ahead, Mykia.
And, you know, and especially in like local elections, right? A lot of local elections are determined by a really small amount of votes. It's not like, you know, I live in a town where we have 0.01 porcelain pigs decorating our downtown, and everything is shut down on Sundays and everything closes by 6 o'clock. Now I'm from a major city originally, not too far from New York City, and now I live in this small town. I can guarantee you that the elections in my small town have not been determined by thousands of votes where somebody be like, okay, if I don't vote, it doesn't matter. No, every vote counts. Like a lot of these smaller and local elections are determined by just a few, like just maybe 30, 40, maybe 100 different votes. And it's super like, and then on top of that, how can you complain, or how can you feel like you have the right to complain or the right to anything if you're not exercising your rights? It just doesn't make any sense at all. Like, if you want something to be, then you need to do. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Now, I want to go back to something that Timia had talked about a little bit earlier when she brought about the voter buster of the week. And she brought up the mortgage company, Fairway, in Birmingham, Alabama, who had been, how long did you say, Timia, from 2020 something to 2020 something?
Yes, up until 2024. I do know that much. I have to go back. Don't put me on the spot.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot, but for some time, Fairway had been practicing redlining in the Birmingham area. And I know a lot of times people say that we're all on an equal level playing field, but that is just not the case. And I think it was between 2018 and 2022, where Fairway only gave only 3.7% of Fairway's applications were for properties in majority Black areas, compared to 12.2% for Fairway's peer lenders. So this had been going on, or redlining the Black neighborhoods had been going on in Fairway from 2015 through 2022. So, how can your one vote make a difference? All right, I'm glad you asked that question. So, let me talk to you about redlining and why you should vote, or why you should vote against it. Voting matters in the fight against redlining. Voting for candidates who prioritize fair housing and anti-discrimination laws can strengthen policies that hold financial institutions accountable. Local leaders who advocate for reinvestment in historically redlined areas can direct resources towards housing, education, and healthcare, helping to reverse the damage caused by years. Okay, let me say it one more time. By years of disinvestment. Voting for ballot measures or representatives who support affordable housing can create opportunities for low-income and minority communities to access safe, stable housing. Electing officials who pledge to enforce the Community Reinvestment Act, the CRA, and other fair lending laws ensure the banks are held accountable for lending practices that benefit all communities equally. Black families continue to have significantly lower home ownership rates compared to white families, largely due to the legacy of redlining. Neighborhoods that were historically redlined often have underfunded schools due to the low poverty taxes, low property taxes, perpetuating a cycle of poor educational outcomes. And I wish we had more time to get for me to get on my soapbox about funding for schools, but maybe next week Makia will let us talk about that. Redlined communities often face environmental hazards and have limited access to healthcare facilities, contributing to worse health outcomes. Voting for officials committed to enforcing the Fair Housing Act ensures that discriminatory practices in lending are addressed. Supporting candidates who advocate for affordable housing investment in underserved communities, stimulating economic growth in historically redlined areas. This is how you strengthen the CRA. This is how you address affordable housing policies. And by voting, you can help to combat the systemic effects of redlining and pushing for policies that promote equality in housing, lending, and economic opportunity. Every vote contributes to shaping policies that can either continue to dismantle discriminatory practices. The recent decision by a mortgage company to pay millions over allegations of redlining in Birmingham highlights the ongoing issues of discriminatory practices in housing finances. There are disastrous effects of redlining, but there are also potential solutions and relevant statistics to illustrate the problem and its future implications. And if you just take the time out to vote for individuals who have your best interests at heart, we can make our local, our state, and our nationals a whole lot better. You're listening to the Communication Workers of America, CWA, our power, a justice-filled hour of talk, solidarity, and worker power. And don't forget, you can listen to us live every Thursday at 10 a.m., 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on kylkradio.org. And you can now download us on your favorite podcast player, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, YouTube Music, iHeartRadio, and Podchaser. You may also listen to us live on CWA Strong app. So tune in to us on those days, on Thursdays, that is. As we come down into the final minutes of the show, our union brothers, sisters, and siblings at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette have been outside for 24 months, 2 years on the picket lines. And yet, while they are out striking, they are still churning out the news with facts for you and I. Let's continue to support them at cwa.org/ppg-donate. And I just heard someone shout, "We are one." That's right, we are one. Our brothers, sisters, and siblings at Maximus are still fighting for a contract. And since you are out in a giving spirit, go over to cwa.org/CCW Solidarity Fund and support the workers of Maximus. October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, National Bullying Prevention Month, and Domestic Violence Awareness Month. October and all of its awareness campaigns serve as a powerful reminder that there are steps we all must take in looking out for loved ones, the people in our community, and those who have been impacted. It's time to take one big step together and make change. Thank you to all of our guests for being here this morning. And don't forget the Nigel Shelby Foundation. You may check them out and get a copy of the book, A Need for Nigel, and I Am Enough, at the NigelShelbyFoundation.org. An hour is not long enough to be with you, and a week is too long to be away from you. You have been tuned into the CWA Human Rights Justice Our Power radio show. I hope something you heard today has inspired you to take action toward creating positive change in the world. Every person has the power to make a difference, no matter how small. And by working together, we can create a world where human rights are respected and valued. So I encourage each of you in the listening audience to reflect on your role in promoting human rights to effect change in your communities and beyond. Know that you are not alone in your quest for a more just and equitable world. When faced with injustice, it can be easy to lose hope and give up. But remember, justice may be slow like the truth, but when it finally comes, it will stand. Until next Thursday, 10 a.m. Central Standard Time, right here on KYK, 1140 a.m. in the all-new 106.5 FM, kylkradio.org, or your favorite podcast listener device. The power of the ballot. Get out and vote. See you next Thursday, 10 a.m. Central Standard Time.